Thanks for tuning into the podcast. Before we start the show, I want to let you know something. My latest novel, Personal Fable, is free for the next few days. So if you're hearing this ad, it's currently free if you're a Kindle user. So just look it up on your Kindle. If you don't have a Kindle, you can even get one of those for free by getting the free Kindle app on your phone. And then head over, get Personal Fable, have a read, and if you love it, leave a review. And I hope you love the story. Now, let's get on with the podcast. P.S. The promotion runs the 11th, 12th, and 13th of March. Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the best podcast ever. Talking about Of Human Bondage, Chapter 96. My table is super squeaky today. What's going on with this table? I believe we saw a snippet of Mildred's true colours. Yeah. She's horrible. We knew she's horrible. And she accidentally let it all out. Acoustic Eel says, bye, bitch. Joke. She's going to come right back and grovel, and it's going to work. I Am a Norwegian says, we didn't really learn anything new about Mildred here. She really is as shallow as she appears. Philip, sticking to his guns, is satisfying, though. One thing that got me a little angry is Mildred musing over how angry she would make Philip by abusing her own child. Yeah, I mean, not just the end of the chapter where she, you know, said all the insults, but the whole chapter was an interesting one because it was sort of from her point of view and how her mind works. And the one thing I was wrong about was saying that she probably gets some kind of a thrill from the work she does. And it kind of confessed here that, you know, she really didn't enjoy it. But still, I think she still got some enjoyment out of upsetting Philip, you know. I think she get, you know, we saw that with her, you know, getting pleasure out of abusing her own child because it upset Philip, and she sort of liked having that power over him. And I think there was probably some perverse way that she got pleasure out of how distraught Philip got over her actions. I Am Norwegian also says this. Another thing this chapter made me think about is how my mother treated a boyfriend of hers. He was the nicest guy, the most well put together, well intentioned man she had ever been involved with. But like Philip, he was nice in that way which many women feel weak. He wasn't assertive enough, and both my mother and Art would become sort of malicious towards him, much like if they really thought of him like Mildred thought of Philip. They aren't mean or ill-intentioned normally, but it's like an instinct takes over when some women come in contact with men who are nice. I still feel bad for the guy, and guess who's complaining about not meeting any good men? I dislike Mildred, but I loved this chapter. It can't be easy to make a shallow character like that feel so true. Yeah, I've come across heaps of women like that where it's like it's almost like the cliche or the meme of like they all say they want a nice guy, but when they get a nice guy, it's intolerable, it's insufferable, because they're pushovers, and I guess women don't want to date a pushover. And as a man, I could say the same thing. I don't want to date a pushover of a girl, but partly of that is because I am, you know, I can be assertive, I suppose. I'm not a pushover myself, I don't think, and if I like something, I'll say I like it. If I don't like it, I'll say, eh, that's not for me. And I don't like dating people who are pushovers because I feel like I always get my own way, you know? And it's not a good feeling because you don't know where you stand when people just say yes all the time. And it's not a nice feeling to not know where you stand. So when people are assertive, even if they come across as sort of maybe bossy or opinionated, at least you know where you stand. And that's it's a comforting thing, you know. On a minor scale, you know, you've all dated the person where they, whenever you say, what do you want for dinner? They always say, I don't mind, whatever you want. And then, you know, it's like, they're too agreeable. It gets uncomfortable to be around someone who's too agreeable. And Philip might be too agreeable. Or maybe he was too agreeable, and that's why Mildred felt him to be weak. I don't know. Anyway, what I Am Norwegian was talking about there, about sort of women don't like to date a weak guy or a non-assertive guy. Yeah, I've seen that kind of stuff all the time. There's a kind of pettiness about that too, isn't there? Like, the whole, why are guys all assholes, but then when you date someone who's not an asshole, you become the asshole. And in a very petty way. You know, I feel like in the example you gave about, what was it, your mum and your auntie, you know, you see the pettiness come out of people when in those kinds of situations. You said they were malicious towards him. And I don't know. Why dating can bring out the worst in people, can't it? Relationships can bring out the worst. You hope they bring out the best, but they don't always. Laura Y. Stitch said, yes, Mildred is a horrible person, but it was interesting to have a chapter from a different perspective. It was quite a long chapter, but it flew by. The ending was great. Throwback to when Philip used the same to manipulate Mildred. It was nice to see Mildred's ultimate sort of manipulation not work. She always thought she had the upper hand, apparently, according to earlier parts of that chapter. And then at the end, she's tried to, like, okay, I'll really put it into fifth gear now and get Philip to stop mucking around, and I'll get what I want, which is to regain the upper hand in this living situation. And when it didn't work out, she flipped her lid. Petty, petty person. It was kind of satisfying in a way. And you knew that all that was right under the surface. All those insults, all those things she said about never loving him and all that, and being disgusted by him. You knew that was all there. All right, let's keep reading. Chapter 97. Philip awoke with a start next morning, conscious that it was late, and looking at his watch, found it was 9 o'clock. He jumped out of bed and went into the kitchen to get himself some hot water to shave with. There was no sign of Mildred, and the things which she had used for her supper the night before still lay in the sink unwashed. He knocked at her door. "Wake up, Mildred, it's awfully late." She did not answer, even after a second louder knocking, and he concluded that she was sulking. He was in too great a hurry to bother about that. He put some water on to boil and jumped into his bath, which was always poured out the night before in order to take the chill off. He presumed that Mildred would cook his breakfast while he was dressing and leave it in the sitting room. She had done that 2 or 3 times when she was out of temper. But he heard no sound of her moving and realized that if he wanted anything to eat, he would have to get it himself. He was irritated that she should play him such a trick on a morning when he had overslept himself. There was still no sign of her when he was ready, but he heard her moving about the room. She was evidently getting up. He made himself some tea and cut himself a couple of pieces of bread and butter, which he ate while he was putting on his boots, then bolted downstairs and along the street into the main road to catch his tram, while his eyes sought out the newspaper shops to see the war news on the placards. He thought of the scene of the night before. Now that it was over and he had slept on it, he could not help thinking it grotesque. He supposed he had been ridiculous, but he was not master of his feelings. At the time, they had been overwhelming. He was angry with Mildred because she had forced him into that absurd position. And then, with renewed astonishment, he thought of her outburst and the filthy language she had used. He could not help flushing when he remembered her final jibe, but he shrugged his shoulders contemptuously. He had long known that when his fellows were angry with him, they never failed to taunt him with his deformity. He had seen men at the hospital imitate his walk, not before him as they used to at school, but when they thought he was not looking. He knew now that they did it from no willful unkindness, but because man is naturally an imitative animal, and because it was an easy way to make people laugh. He knew it, but he could never resign himself to it. He was glad to throw himself into his work. The ward seemed pleasant and friendly when he entered it. The sister greeted him with a quick businesslike smile. "You're very late, Mr. Carey. I was out on the loose last night." "You look it." "Thank you." Laughing, he went to the first of his cases, a boy with tuberculosis ulcers. and removed his bandages, the boy was pleased to see him, and Philip chafed him as he put a clean dressing on the wound. Philip was a favourite with the patients, he treated them good-humouredly, and he had gentle, sensitive hands which did not hurt them. Some of the dressers were a little rough and happy-go-lucky in their methods. He lunched with his friends in the club room, a frugal meal consisting of a scone and butter, with a cup of cocoa, and they talked of the war. Several men were going out, but the authorities were particular and refused everyone who had not had a hospital appointment. Someone suggested that if the war went on in a while, they would be glad to take anyone who was qualified, but the general opinion was that it would be over in a month. Now that Roberts was there, things would get all right in no time. This was McAllister's opinion too, and he had told Philip that they must watch their chance and buy just before peace was declared. There would be a boom then, and they might all make a bit of money. Philip had left with McAllister's instructions to buy him stock whenever the opportunity presented itself. His appetite had been whetted by the £30 he had made in the summer, and he wanted now to make a couple of hundred. He finished his day's work and got on a tram to go back to Kennington. He wondered how Mildred would behave that evening. It was a nuisance to think she would probably be surly and refuse to answer his questions. It was a warm evening for the time of year, and even in those grey streets of South London there was a languor of February. Nature is restless. Then, after the long winter months, growing things awake from their sleep, and there is a rustle in the earth, a forerunner of spring as it resumes its eternal activities. Philip would have liked to drive on further. It was distasteful to him to go back to his rooms, and he wanted the air, but the desire to see the child clutched suddenly at his heartstrings, and he smiled to himself as he thought of her toddling towards him with a crow of delight. He was surprised when he reached the house and looked up mechanically at the windows to see that there was no light. He went upstairs and knocked, but got no answer. When Mildred went out, she left the key under the mat, and he found it there now. He let himself in, and going into the sitting room, struck a match. Something had happened. He did not at once know what. He turned the gas on full and lit it. The room was suddenly filled with the glare, and he looked around. He gasped. The whole place was wrecked. Everything in it had been willfully destroyed. Anger seized him, and he rushed into Mildred's room. It was dark and empty. When he had got a light, he saw that she had taken away all her things, and the babies. He had noticed on entering that the go-cart was not in its usual place on the landing, but thought Mildred had taken the baby out, and all the things on the washing stand had been broken. A knife had been drawn crossways through the seats on the two chairs. The pillow had been split open. There were large gashes in the sheets and the counterpane. The looking glass appeared to have been broken with a hammer. Philip was bewildered. He went into his own room, and here too everything was in confusion. The basin and the ewer had been smashed, the looking glass was in fragments, and the sheets were in ribbons. Mildred had made a slit large enough to put her hand into the pillow, and had scattered the feathers about the room. She had jabbed a knife into the blankets. On the dressing table were photographs of Philip's mother. The frames had been smashed and the glass shivered. Philip went into the tiny kitchen. Everything that was breakable was broken. Glasses, pudding basins, plates and dishes. It took Philip's breath away. Mildred had left no letter, nothing but this ruin to mark her anger, and he could imagine the set face with which she had gone about her work. He went back into the sitting room and looked about him. He was so astonished that he no longer felt angry. He looked curiously at the kitchen knife and the coal hammer, which were laying on the table where she had left them. Then his eye caught a large carving knife in the fireplace, which had been broken. It must have taken her a long time to do such damage. Lawson's portrait of him had been cut crossways and gaped hideously. His own drawings had been ripped in pieces, and the photographs, Manet's Olympia and the Odalisque of Ingres, the portrait of Philip IV, had been smashed with great blows with a coal hammer. There were gashes in the tablecloth and in the curtains and in the two armchairs. They were quite ruined. On one wall over the table, which Philip used as his desk, was a little bit of Persian rug which Cronshaw had given him. Mildred had always hated it. "If it's a rug, it ought to go on the floor," she said, "and it's a dirty, stinking bit of stuff, that's all it is." It made her furious because Philip told her it contained the answers to a great riddle. She thought he was making fun of her. She had drawn the knife right through it 3 times. It must have required some strength, and it hung now in tatters. Philip had 2 or 3 blue or white plates, of no value, and he had bought them one by one for very small sums and liked them for their associations. They littered the floor in fragments. There were long gashes on the backs of his books, and she had taken the trouble to tear pages out of the unbound French ones. The little ornaments on the chimney piece lay on the hearth in bits. Everything that it had been possible to destroy with a knife or a hammer was destroyed. The whole of Philip's belongings would not have sold for £30, but most of them were old friends, and he was a domestic creature attached to all those odds and ends because they were his. He had been proud of his little home, and on so little money had made it pretty and characteristic. He sank down now in despair. He asked himself how she could have been so cruel. A sudden fear got him on his feet again, and into the passage where stood a cupboard in which he kept his clothes. He opened it and gave a sigh of relief. She had apparently forgotten it, and none of his things were touched. He went back into the sitting room and, surveying the scene, wondered what to do, and had not the heart to begin trying to set things straight. Besides, there was no food in the house, and he was hungry. He went out and got himself something to eat. When he came in, he was cooler. A little pang seized him as he thought of the child, and he wondered whether she would miss him. At first, perhaps, but in a week she would have forgotten him, and he was thankful to be rid of Mildred. He did not think of her with wrath, but with an overwhelming sense of boredom. "I hope to God I never see her again," he said out loud. The only thing now was to leave the rooms, and he made up his mind to give notice the next morning. He could not afford to make good the damage done, and he had so little money left that he must find cheaper lodgings still. He would be glad to get out of them. The expense had worried him, and now the recollection of Mildred would be in them always. Philip was impatient and could never rest till he had put in action the plan which he had in mind. So, on the following afternoon, he got in a dealer in second-hand furniture, who offered him £3 for all his goods, damaged and undamaged, and 2 days later he moved into the house opposite the hospital in which he had had rooms when first he became a medical student. The landlady was a very decent woman. He took a bedroom at the top, which she let him have for 6 shillings a week. It was small and shabby and looked on the yard of the house that backed onto it, but he had nothing now except his clothes and a box of books, and he was glad to lodge so cheaply. All right, there we go. There's another chapter for you, Mildred. Another little hint at her true colours. Just a hint. I think there's much more rage and destruction inside her. Have your say about the chapter over on the subreddit. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.